gate anyway, and she hadn't checked that one today. The wharfs were oddly quiet when Arya got there. She spied another pair of gold cloaks walking side by side through the fish market, but they never so much as looked at her. Half the stalls were empty, and it seemed to her that there were fewer ships at dock than she remembered. Out on the black water, three of the king's war galleys moved in formation, gold-painted hulls splitting the water as their oars rose and fell. Arya watched them for a bit. They began to make her way along the river. When she saw the guardsmen on the third pier, in grey woolen cloaks trimmed with white satin, her heart almost stopped in her chest. The sight of Winterfell's colours brought tears to her eyes. Behind them, a sleek, three-banked trading galley rocked at her moorings. Arya could not read the name painted on the hull. The words were strange. Mirish, Bravassi, perhaps even High Valyrian. She grabbed a passing longshoreman by the sleeve. "Please," she said, "what ship is this?"
"She's a wind witch out of Myr," the man said.
"She's still here?" Arya blurted. The longshoreman gave her a queer look, shrugged, and walked away. Arya ran toward the pier. The Wind Witch was the ship father had hired to take her home, still waiting. She imagined it had sailed ages ago. Two of the guardsmen were dicing together while the third walked rounds, his hand on the pommel of his sword. Ashamed to let them see her crying like a baby, she stopped to rub her eyes. Her eyes, her eyes, her eyes. Why did...
"Look with your eyes," she heard Syrio whisper.
Arya looked. She knew all of her father's men. The three in the grey cloaks were strangers. "You!" the one walking the rounds called out. "What do you want here, boy?" The other two looked up from their dice. It was all Arya could do not to bolt and run. But she knew that if she did, they would be after her at once. She made herself walk closer. They were looking for a girl, but he thought she was a boy. She'd be a boy then.
"Want to buy a pigeon?"
She showed them the dead bird.
"Get out of here," the guardsman said.
Arya did as he told her. She did not have to pretend to be frightened. Behind her, the men went back to their dice. She could not have said how she got back to Flea Bottom, but she was breathing hard by the time she reached the narrow, crooked, unpaved streets between the hills. The bottom had a stench to it, a stench of pigsties and stables and tanner's sheds, mixed in with a sour smell of wine sinks and cheap whorehouses. Arya wound her way through the maze dully. It was not until she caught a whiff of bubbling brown coming through a potshop door that she realized her pigeon was gone. It must have slipped from her belt as she ran, or someone had stolen it and she never noticed. For a moment she wanted to cry again. She'd have to walk all the way back to the Street of Flower to find another one that plump. Far across the city, bells began to ring. Arya glanced up, listening, wondering what the ringing meant this time.
"What's this now?" a fat man called from the potshop.
"The bells again, God have mercy," wailed an old woman.
A red-headed whore in a wisp of painted silk pushed open a second-story window.
"Is it the boy king that's died now?"
she shouted down, leaning out over the street.
"Ah, that's a boy for you. They never last long."
She laughed. A naked man slid his arm around her from behind, biting her neck and rubbing the heavy white breasts that hung loose beneath her shift.
"Stupid slut," the fat man shouted up. "The king's not dead. That's only summoning bells. One tower tolling. When the king dies, they ring every bell in the city."
"Here, quit your biting, or I'll ring your bells,"
the woman in the window said to the man behind her, pushing him off with an elbow.
So who is it died, if not the king?
It's a summoning, the fat man repeated. Two boys close to Arya's age scampered past, splashing through a puddle. The old woman cursed them, but they kept right on going. Other people were moving too, heading up the hill to see what the noise was about. Arya ran after the slower boy. "Where are you going?" she shouted when she was right behind him. "What's happening?" He glanced back without slowing.
"The gold coax is carrying him to the sept."
"Who?" she yelled, running hard.
"The end. They'll be taking his head off, Boo says."
A passing wagon had left a deep rut in the street. The boy leapt over, but Arya never saw it. She tripped and fell face first, scraping her knee open on a stone and smashing her fingers where her hand hit the hard-packed earth. Needle tangled between her legs. She sobbed as she struggled to her knees. The thumb of her left hand was covered with blood. When she sucked on it, she saw that half the thumbnail was gone, ripped off in the fall. Her hand throbbed, and her knee was all bloody, too.
"Make way!" somebody shouted from the cross street. "Make way for my lords of red wine!"
It was all Arya could do to get out of the road before they ran her down. Four guardsmen on huge horses, pounding past at a gallop. They wore check cloaks, blue and burgundy. Behind them, two young lordlings rode side by side on a pair of chestnut mares, alike as peas in a pod. Arya had seen them in the bailey 100 times. The red wine twins, Sir Horace and Sir Hubba. Homely youths with orange hair and square, freckled faces. Sansa and Jane Poole used to call them Sir Horror and Sir Slobber, and giggle whenever they caught sight of them. They did not look funny now. Everyone was moving in the same direction, all in a hurry to see what the ringing was all about. The bell seemed louder now, clanging, calling. Arya joined the stream of people. Her thumb hurt so bad where the nail had broken that it was all she could do not to cry. She bit her lip as she limped along, listening to the excited voices around her.
"The king's hand, Lord Stark! They're carrying him up to Baelor's Sept. I heard he was dead. Soon enough, soon enough. Here, I got me a silver stag, says they lop his head off." "Past time, the traitor,"
the man spat. Arya struggled to find a voice. "He never," she started, but she was only a child, and they talked right over her.
"Fool, they ain't neither going to lop him. Since when do they nick traitors on the steps of the great sept?" "Well, they don't mean to anoint him no knight. I heard it was Stark killed old King Robert, slit his throat in the woods, and when they found him, he stood there, cool as you please, and said it was some old boar did for his grace."
"Aye, and that's not true. It was his own brother did him, that Renly, him with the gold antlers."
"You shut your lying mouth, woman. You don't know what you're saying. His lordship's a fine, true man."
By the time they reached the street of the sisters, they were packed in shoulder to shoulder. Arya let the human current carry her along up to the top of Visenya's hill. The white marble plaza was a solid mass of people, all yammering excitedly at each other and straining to get closer to the great sept of Baelor. The bells were very loud here. Arya squirmed through the press, ducking between the legs of horses and clutching tight to a sword stick. From the middle of the crowd, all she could see were arms and legs and stomachs, and the 7 slender towers of the sept looming overhead. She spotted a wood wagon and thought to climb up on the back, where she might be able to see. But others had the same idea. The teamster cursed at them and drove them off with a crack of his whip. Arya grew frantic. Forcing her way to the front of the crowd, she was shoved up against the stone of a plinth. She looked up at Baelor, the Blessed, the Septon King. Sliding her stick sword through her belt, Arya began to climb. Her broken thumbnail left smears of blood on the painted marble, but she made it up and wedged herself in between the king's feet. That was when she saw her father. Lord Eddard stood on the High Septon's pulpit outside the doors of the sept, supported between two of the gold cloaks. He was dressed in a rich grey velvet doublet, with a white wolf sewn on the front in beads, and a grey wool cloak trimmed with fur. But he was thinner than Arya had ever seen him, his long face drawn with pain. He was not standing so much as being held up. The cast over his broken leg was grey and rotten. The High Septon himself stood behind him, a squat man, grey with age and ponderously fat, wearing long white robes and an immense crown of spun gold and crystal that wreathed his head with rainbows whenever he moved. Clustered around the doors of the sept, in front of the raised marble pulpit, were a knot of knights and high lords. Joffrey was prominent among them, his raiment all crimson, silk and satin patterned with prancing stags and roaring lions, a gold crown on his head. His queen mother stood beside him in a black mourning gown slashed with crimson, a veil of black diamonds in her hair. Arya recognized the Hound, wearing a snowy white cloak over his dark grey armour, with four of the king's guard around him. She saw Varys, the eunuch, gliding among the lords in soft slippers and a patterned damask robe, and she thought the short man with a silvery cape and pointed beard might be the one who had once fought a duel for Mother. And there, in the midst, was Sansa, dressed in sky-blue silk, with her long auburn hair washed and curled, and silver bracelets on her wrist. Arya scowled, wondering what her sister was doing here, why she looked so happy. A long line of gold-cloaked spearmen held back the crowd, commanded by a stout man in elaborate armour, all black lacquer and gold filigree. His cloak had the metallic shimmer of true cloth of gold. When the bell ceased to toll, a quiet slowly settled across the great plaza, and her father lifted his head and began to speak, his voice so thin and weak she could scarcely make him out. People behind her began to shout out, "What?" and "Louder!" The man in the black and gold armour stepped up behind Father and prodded him sharply. "You leave him alone," Arya wanted to shout, but she knew no one would listen. She chewed her lip. Her father raised his voice and began again. "I am Eddard Stark, Lord of Winterfell, and Hand of the King," he said more loudly, his voice carrying across the plaza, "and I come before you to confess my treason in the sight of gods and men." "No," Arya whimpered. Below her, the crowd began to scream and shout. Taunts and obscenities filled the air. Sansa had hidden her face in her hands. Her father raised his voice still higher, straining to be heard. "I betrayed the faith of my king and the trust of my friend Robert," he shouted. "I swore to defend and protect his children. Yet before his blood was cold, I plotted to depose and murder his son, and seize the throne for myself. Let the High Septon and Baelor the Beloved and the Seven bear witness to the truth of what I say. Joffrey Baratheon is the one true heir to the Iron Throne, and by the grace of all the gods, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm." A stone came sailing out of the crowd. Arya cried out as she saw her father hit. The gold cloaks kept him from falling. Blood ran down his face from a deep gash across his forehead. More stones followed. One struck the guard to Father's left. Another went clanging off the breastplate of the knight in the black and gold armour. Two of the king's guard stepped in front of Joffrey and the queen, protecting them with their shields. Her hand slid beneath her cloak and found needle in its sheath. She tightened her fingers around the grip, squeezing as hard as she had ever squeezed anything. "Please, guards, keep him safe," she prayed. "Don't let them hurt my father." The High Septon knelt before Joffrey and his mother.
"As we sin, so do we suffer," he intoned, in a deep, swelling voice, much louder than father's. "This man has confessed his crimes in the sight of gods and men, here in this holy place."
Rainbows danced around his head as he lifted his hands in entreaty.
"The gods are just, yet blessed Baelor taught us that they are also merciful. What shall be done with this traitor, your grace?"
A thousand voices were screaming, but Arya never heard them. Prince Joffrey, no, King Joffrey, stepped out from behind the shields of his king's guard.
"My mother bids me let Lord Eddard take the black, and Lady Sansa has begged mercy for her father."
He looked straight at Sansa then, and smiled, and for a moment Arya thought that the guards had heard her prayer, until Joffrey turned back to the crowd and said,
"But they have the soft hearts of women. So long as I am your king, treason shall never go unpunished. Sir Ilion, bring me his head."
The crowd roared, and Arya felt the statue of Baelor rock as they surged against it. The High Septon clutched at the king's cape, and Varys came rushing over, waving his arms, and even the queen was saying something to him, but Joffrey shook his head. Lords and knights moved aside as he stepped through, tall and fleshless, a skeleton in iron mail, the king's justice. Dimly, as from far off, Arya heard her sister scream. Sansa had fallen to her knees, sobbing hysterically. Sir Ilion Payne climbed the steps of the pulpit. Arya wriggled between Baelor's feet and threw herself into the crowd, drawing needle. She landed on a man in a butcher's apron, knocking him to the ground. Immediately someone slammed into her back, and she almost went down herself. Bodies closed in around her, stumbling and pushing, trampling on the poor butcher. Arya slashed at them with needle. High atop the pulpit, Sir Ilion Payne gestured, and the knight in black and gold gave a command. The gold cloaks flung Lord Eddard to the marble, with his head and chest out over the edge.
"Here, you!"
an angry voice shouted at Arya, but she bowled past, shoving people aside, squirming between them, slamming into anyone in her way. A hand fumbled at her leg, and she hacked at it, kicked at shins. A woman stumbled, and Arya ran up her back, cutting to both sides. But it was no good, no good. There were too many people. No sooner did she make a hole than it closed again. Someone buffeted her aside. She could still hear Sansa screaming. Sir Ilion drew a two-handed greatsword from the scabbard on his back. As he lifted the blade above his head, sunlight seemed to ripple and dance down the dark metal, glinting off an edge sharper than any razor. "Ice," she thought. "He has ice." Her tears streamed down her face, blinding her. And then a hand shot out of the press and closed around her arm like a wolf trap, so hard that needle went flying from her hand. Arya was wrenched off her feet. She would have fallen if he hadn't held her up, as easy as if she were a doll. A face pressed close to hers, long black hair and tangled beard and rotten teeth.
Don't look.
A thick voice snarled at her. Arya sobbed. The old man shook her so hard, her teeth rattled.
Shut your mouth and close your eyes, boy.
Dimly, as if from far away, she heard a noise. A soft, sighing sound, as if a million people had let out their breath at once. The old man's fingers dug into her arm, stiff as iron.
Look at me. Yes, that's the way of it. At me.
Sarwine perfumed his breath.
Remember, boy.
It was the smell that did it. Arya saw the matted, greasy hair, the patched, dusty black cloak that covered his twisted shoulders, the hard black eyes squinting at her, and she remembered the black brother who had come to visit her father.
Know me now, do you? There's a bright boy.
He spat.
They're done here. You'll be coming with me. And you'll be keeping your mouth shut.
When she started to reply, he shook her again, even harder.
Shut, I said.
The plaza was beginning to empty. The press dissolved around them as people drifted back to their lives. But Arya's life was gone. Numb, she trailed along beside Yoren. Yes, his name is Yoren. She did not recall him finding Needle until he handed the sword back to her.
Hope you can use that, boy.
I'm not, she started. He shoved her into a doorway, thrust dirty fingers through her hair, gave it a twist, yanking her head back.
Not a smart boy. That what you mean to say?
He had a knife in his other hand. As the blade flashed toward her face, Arya threw herself backward, kicking wildly, wrenching her head from side to side. But he had her by the hair so strong she could feel her scalp tearing, and on her lips the salt taste of tears. Bran. The oldest were men grown, 17 or 18 years from the day of their naming. One was past 20. Most were younger, 16 or less. Bran watched them from the balcony of Maester Luwin's turret, listening to them grunt and strain and curse as they swung their staves and wooden swords. The yard was alive to the clack of wood on wood, punctuated all too often by thwacks and yowls of pain when a blow struck leather or flesh. Sir Roderick strode among the boys, face reddening beneath his white whiskers, muttering at them, one and all. Bran had never seen the old knight look so fierce.
No, he kept saying, no, no, no.
They don't fight very well, Bran said dubiously. He scratched Summer idly behind the ears as the dire wolf tore at a haunch of meat. Bones crunched between his teeth.
For a certainty, Maester Luwin agreed with a deep sigh.
The maester was peering through his big mirrorish lens tube, measuring shadows and noting the position of the comet that hung low in the morning sky.
Yet given time, Sir Roderick has the truth of it. We need men to walk the walls. Your lord father took the cream of his guard to King's Landing, and your brother took the rest, along with all the likely lads for leagues around. Many will not come back to us, and we must needs find the men to take their places.
Bran stared resentfully at the sweating boys below.
If I still had my legs, I could beat them all.
He remembered the last time he'd held a sword in his hand, when the king had come to Winterfell. It was only a wooden sword, yet he'd knocked Prince Tommen down 50 times. Sir Roderick should teach me to use a poleaxe. If I had a poleaxe with a big long haft, Hodor could be my legs. We could be a knight together.
I think that unlikely, Maester Luwin said. Bran, when a man fights, his arms and legs and thoughts must be as one.
Below in the yard, Sir Roderick was yelling, "You fight like a goose. He pecks you, and you peck him harder. Parry! Block the blow! Goose fighting will not suffice. If those were real swords, the first peck would take your arm off." One of the other boys laughed, and the old knight rounded on him. "You laugh, you! Now that is gall. You fight like a hedgehog." "There was a knight once who couldn't see," Bran said stubbornly, as Sir Roderick went on below. "Old Nan told me about him. He had a long staff with blades at both ends, and he could spin it in his hands and chop two men at once."
"Simeon the Star Eyes," Lewin said, as he marked numbers in a book. "When he lost his eyes, he put star sapphires in the empty sockets, or so the singers claim. Bran, that is only a story like the tales of Florian the Fool, a fable from the age of heroes."
The maester tisked.
"You must put these dreams aside. They will only break your heart."
The mention of dreams reminded him. "I dreamt about the crow again last night, the one with three eyes. He flew into my bedchamber and told me to come with him, so I did. We went down to the crypts. Father was there, and we talked. He was sad."
"And why was that?"
Lewin peered through his tube. "It was something to do about John, I think. The dream had been deeply disturbing, more so than any of the other crow dreams. Hodor won't go down into the crypts." The maester had only been half listening, Bran could tell. He lifted his eye from the tube, blinking.
"Hodor won't go down into the crypts.
When I woke, I told him to take me down to see if Father was truly there.
At first, he didn't know what I was saying, but I got him to the steps by telling him to go here and go there. Only then he wouldn't go down. He just stood on the top step and said, 'Hodor,' like he was scared of the dark. But I had a torch. It made me so mad I almost gave him a swat in the head, like old Nan is always doing." He saw the way the maester was frowning and hurriedly added, "I didn't, though."
"Good. Hodor is a man, not a mule to be beaten.
In the dream, I flew down with a crow. But I can't do that when I'm awake," Bran explained.
"Why would you want to go down to the crypts?"
"I told you, to look for Father."
The maester tugged at the chain around his neck, as he often did when he was uncomfortable.
"Bran, sweet child, one day Lord Eddard will sit below in stone, beside his father, and his father's father, and all the Starks back to the old kings in the north. But that will not be for many years, gods be good. Your father is a prisoner of the Queen, in King's Landing. You will not find him in the crypts."
"He was there last night. I talked to him."
Stubborn boy," the maester sighed, setting his book aside. "Would you like to go see?"
"I can't. Hodor won't go, and the steps are too narrow and twisty for Dancer."
"I believe I can solve that difficulty."
In place of Hodor, the wildling woman, Usha, was summoned. She was tall and tough and uncomplaining, willing to go wherever she was commanded.
"I've lived my life beyond the wall. A hole in the ground won't fret me none, my lords," she said.
"Summer, come," Bran called as she lifted him in wiry, strong arms. The dire wolf left his bone and followed as Usher carried Bran across the yard and down the spiral steps to the cold vault under the earth. Maester Lewin went ahead with a torch. Bran did not even mind, too badly, that she carried him in her arms and not on her back. Sir Roderick had ordered Usher's chain struck off, since she had served faithfully and well, since she had been at Winterfell. She still wore the heavy iron shackles around her ankles, a sign that she was not yet wholly trusted. But they did not hinder her sure strides down the steps. Bran could not recall the last time he'd been in the crypts. It had been before, for certain. When he was little, he used to play down here with Rob and John and his sisters. He wished they were here now. The vault might not have seemed so dark and scary. Summer stalked out in the echoing gloom, then stopped, lifted his head,
and sniffed the chill dead air. He bared his teeth and crept backward, eyes glowing golden in the light of the maester's torch. Even Usher, hard as iron, seemed uncomfortable.
"Grim folks, by the look of them,"
she said, as she eyed the long row of granite stocks on their stone thrones.
"They were the kings of winter,"
Bran whispered. Somehow it felt wrong to talk too loudly in this place. Usher smiled.
"Winter's got no king. If you'd seen it, you'd know that, summer boy. They were the kings of the north for thousands of years,"
Maester Lewin said, lifting the torch high so the light shone on the stone faces. Some were hairy and bearded, shaggy men fierce as the wolves that crouched by their feet. Others were shaved clean, their features gaunt and sharp-edged as the iron longswords across their laps.
"Hard men for a hard time. Come."
He strode briskly down the vault, past the procession of stone pillars and the endless carved figures. A tongue of flame trailed back from the upraised torch as he went. The vault was cavernous, longer than Winterfell itself, and John had told him once that there were other levels underneath, vaults even deeper and darker, where the older kings were buried. It would not do to lose the light. Summer refused to move from the steps, even when Usher followed the torch, Bran in her arms.
"Do you recall your history, Bran?"
the maester said as they walked.
"Tell Usher who they were and what they did, if you can."
He looked at the passing faces, and the tales came back to him. The maester had told him the stories, and old Nan had made them come alive. "That one is John Stark. When the sea raiders landed in the east, he drove them out and built the castle at White Harbour. His son was Rickard Stark, not my father's father, but another Rickard. He took the neck away from the March King and married his daughter. Theon Starks, the real thin one with the long hair and the skinny beard, they called him the Hungry Wolf because he was always at war. That's a Brandon, the tall one with a dreamy face. He was Brandon the Shipwright, because he loved the sea. His tomb is empty. He tried to sail west across the Sunset Sea, and was never seen again. His son was Brandon the Burner, because he put the torch to all his father's ships in grief. There's Roderick Stark, who won Bear Island in a wrestling match, and gave it to the Mormonts. And that's Torrhen Stark, the king who knelt. He was the last king in the north, and the First Lord of Winterfell, after he yielded to Aegon the Conqueror. Oh, and there, he's Craegan Stark. He fought with Prince Aemon once, and the Dragonknight said he'd never faced a finer swordsman. They were almost at the end now, and Bran felt a sadness creeping over him. Oh, and there's my grandfather, Lord Rickard, who was beheaded by Mad King Aerys. His daughter, Lyanna, and his son Brandon are in the tombs beside him. Not me, another Brandon, my father's brother. They're not supposed to have statues. That's only for the lords and the kings. But my father loved them so much, he had them done.
The maid's a fair one, Usher said.
Robert was betrothed to marry her, but Prince Rhaegar carried her off and raped her, Bran explained. Robert fought a war to win her back. He killed Rhaegar on the Trident with his hammer, but Lyanna died, and he never got her back at all.
"A sad tale," said Usher, "but those empty holes are sadder. Lord Eddard's tomb, for when his time comes," Maester Lewin said. "Is this where you saw your father, in your dream, Bran?"
"Yes." The memory made him shiver. He looked around the vault uneasily, the hairs on the back of his neck bristling. Had he heard a noise? Was there someone here? Maester Lewin stepped towards the open sepulchre, torch in hand.
"As you see, he's not here. Nor will he be for many a year. Dreams are only dreams, child."
He thrust his arm into the blackness inside the tomb, as into the mouth of some great beast.
"Do you see? It's quite empty.
The darkness sprang at him, snarling. Bran saw eyes like green fire, a flash of teeth, fur as black as the pit around them. Maester Lewin yelled and threw up his hands. The torch went flying from his fingers, caromed off the stone face of Brandon Stark, and tumbled to the statue's feet, the flames licking up his legs. In the drunken, shifting torchlight, they saw Lewin struggling with a direwolf, beating at his muzzle with one hand while the jaws closed on the other. "Summer!" Bran screamed. And Summer came, shooting from the dimness behind them a leaping shadow. He slammed into Shaggy Dog and knocked him back, and the two direwolves rolled over and over in a tangle of grey and black fur, snapping and biting at each other, while Maester Lewin struggled to his knees, his arm torn and bloody. Usher propped Bran up against Lord Rickard's stone wolf as she hurried to assist the maester. In the light of the guttering torch, shadow wolves 20 feet tall fought on the wall and roof.
"Shaggy,"
a small voice called. When Bran looked up, his little brother was standing in the mouth of Father's tomb. With one final snap at Summer's face, Shaggy Dog broke off and bounded to Rickon's side.
"You let my father be,"
Rickon warned Lewin.
"You let him be."
"Rickon," Bran said softly, "father's not here."
"Yes, he is. I saw him."
Tears glistened on Rickon's face.
"I saw him last night."
"In your dream?" Rickon nodded.
"You leave him. You leave him be. He's coming home now, like he promised. He's coming home."
Bran had never seen Maester Lewin look so uncertain before. Blood dripped down his arm, where Shaggy Dog had shredded the wool of his sleeve and the flesh beneath.
"Usher, the torch," he said, biting through his pain,
and she snatched it up before it went out. Soot stains blackened both legs of his uncle's likeness.
That beast," Lewin went on, "is supposed to be chained up in the kennels."
Rickon patted Shaggy Dog's muzzle, damp with blood.
"I let him loose. He doesn't like chains."
He licked at his fingers. "Rickon," Bran said, "would you like to come with me?"
"No, I like it here."
"It's dark here and cold."
"I'm not afraid. I have to wait for father."
"You can wait with me," Bran said. "We'll wait together. You and me and our wolves." Both of the direwolves were licking wounds now and would bear close watching.
"Bran," the maester said firmly, "I know you mean well, but Shaggy Dog is too wild to run loose. I'm the third man he's savaged. Give him the freedom of the castle, and it's only a question of time before he kills someone. The truth is hard, but the wolf has to be chained, or—"
He hesitated. "Or killed," Bran thought. But what he said was, "He was not made for chains. We will wait in your tower, all of us."
"That is quite impossible," Maester Lewin said.
Usher grinned.
"The boy's the lordling here, as I recall."
She handed Lewin back his torch and scooped Bran up into her arms again.
"The maester's tower it is."
"Will you come, Rickon?" His brother nodded.
"If Shaggy comes too,"
he said, running after Usher and Bran, and there was nothing Maester Lewin could do but follow, keeping a wary eye on the wolves. Maester Lewin's turret was so cluttered that it seemed to Bran a wonder that he ever found anything. Tottering piles of books, covered tables and chairs, rows of stoppered jars lined the shelves, candle stubs and puddles of dried wax dotted the furniture. The bronze Moorish lens tube sat on a tripod by the terrace door. Star charts hung from the walls. Shadow maps lay scattered among the rushes. Papers, quills, and pots of ink were everywhere. And all of it was spotted with droppings from the ravens in the rafters. Their strident quarks drifted down from above as Usher washed and cleaned and bandaged the maester's wounds, under Lewin's terse instruction.
"This is folly,"
the small grey man said, while she dabbed at the wolf's bites with a stinging ointment.
"I agree that it is odd that both you boys dreamed the same dream, yet when you stop to consider it, it's only natural.
You miss your Lord Father, and you know that he is a captive. Fear can fever a man's mind and give him queer thoughts. Rickon is too young to comprehend.
I'm 4 now,
Rickon said. He was peering through the lens tube at the gargoyles on the first keep. The direwolves sat on opposite sides of the large round room, licking their wounds and gnawing on bones.
Too young, and oh, 7 hells, that burns. No, no, don't stop. More. Too young, as I say, but you, Bran, you're old enough to know that dreams are only dreams.
Some are, some aren't.
Usher poured pale red fire milk into a long gash. Lewin gasped.
The children of the forest could tell you a thing or two about dreaming.
Tears were streaming down the maester's face, yet he shook his head doggedly.
The children live only in dreams. Now, dead and gone. Enough, that's enough. Now the bandages. Pads, and then wrap. And make it tight. I'll be bleeding.
Old Nan says the children knew the songs of the trees, that they could fly like birds and swim like fish and talk to the animals, Bran said. She says that they made music so beautiful that it made you cry like a little baby just to hear it.
And all this they did with magic,
Maester Lewin said, distracted.
I wish they were here now. A spell would heal my arm less painfully, and they could talk to Shaggy Dog and tell him not to bite.
He gave the big black wolf an angry glance out of the corner of his eye.
Take a lesson, Bran. The man who trusts in spells is dueling with a glass sword, as the children did. Here, let me show you something.
He stood abruptly across the room and returned with a green jar in his good hand.
Have a look at these,
he said, as he pulled the stopper and shook out a handful of shiny black arrowheads. Bran picked one up.
It's made of glass.
Curious, Rickon drifted closer, to peer over the table.
Dragon glass,
Usher named it, as she sat down beside Lewin, bandagings in hand.
Obsidian,
Maester Lewin insisted, holding out his wounded arm.
Forged in the fires of the gods far below the earth. The children of the forest hunted with that thousands of years ago. The children worked no metal. In place of mail, they wore long shirts of woven leaves and bound their legs in bark, so that they seemed to melt into the wood. In place of swords, they carried blades of obsidian. And still do.
Usher placed soft pads over the bites on the maester's forearm and bound them tight with long strips of linen. Bran held the arrowhead up close. The black glass was slick and shiny. He thought it beautiful.
Can I keep one?
As you wish,
the maester said. I want one too,
Rickon said. I want 4. I'm 4.
Lewin made him count them out.
Be careful. They're still sharp. Don't cut yourself.
Tell me about the children, Bran said. It was important.
What do you wish to know? Everything.
Maester Lewin tugged his chain collar where it chafed against his neck.
They were the people of the Dawn Age. The very first, before kings and kingdoms, he said. In those days, there were no castles or holdfasts, no cities, not so much as a market town to be found between here and the Sea of Dawn. There were no men at all. Only the children of the forest dwelt in the lands we now call the Seven Kingdoms. There were a people, dark and beautiful, small of stature, no taller than children, even when grown to manhood. They lived in the depths of the wood, in caves and crannogs and secret tree towns. Slight as they were, the children were quick and graceful. Male and female hunted together, with weirwood bows and flying snares. Their gods were the gods of the forest, stream, and stone, the old gods, whose names are secret. Their wise men were called green seers, and carved strange faces in the weirwoods to keep watch on the woods. How long the children reigned here, or where they came from, no man can know.
But some 12,000 years ago, the first men appeared from the east, crossing the broken arm of dawn before it was broken. They came with bronze swords and great leather shields, riding horses. No horse had ever been seen on this side of the narrow sea. No doubt the children were as frightened by the horses as the first men were by the faces in the trees. As the first men carved out holdfasts and farms, they cut down the faces and gave them to the fire. Horror-struck, the children went to war. The old songs say that the green seers use dark magics to make the sea rise and sweep away the land, shattering the arm. But it was too late to close the door. The wars went on until the earth ran red with blood of men and children both, but more children than men, for men were bigger and stronger, and wood and stone and obsidian make a poor match for bronze. Finally, the wise of both races prevailed, and the chiefs and heroes of the first men met the green seers and wood dancers amidst the weirwood groves of a small island in the great lake called God's Eye. There they forged the pact. The first men were given the coastlands, the high plains and bright meadows, the mountains and bogs, but the deep woods were to remain forever the children's, and no more weirwoods were to be put to the axe anywhere in the realm. So the gods might bear witness to the signing, every tree on the island was given a face, and afterward the sacred order of green men was formed to keep watch over the Isle of Faces. The pact began 4,000 years of friendship between men and children. In time the first men even put aside the gods they had brought with them, and took up the worship of the secret gods of the wood. The signing of the pact ended the Dawn Age, and began the Age of Heroes. Bran's fist curled around the shiny black arrowhead. "But the children of the forest are all gone now," you said.
"Here they are,"
said Osha, as she bit off the end of the last bandage with her teeth.
"North of the wall, things are different. That's where the children went, and the giants, and the other old races."
Maester Lewin sighed. "Oh, woman, by rights, you ought to be dead or in chains.
The Starks have treated you more gently than you deserve. It is unkind to repay them for their kindness by filling the boys' heads with folly."
"Tell me where they went," Bran said. "I want to know."
"Me too,"
Rickon echoed.
"Oh, very well,"
Lewin muttered.
"So long as the kingdoms of the first men held sway, the pact endured. All through the Age of Heroes and the Long Night and the birth of the Seven Kingdoms. Yet finally there came a time, many centuries later, when other peoples crossed the narrow sea. The Andals were the first, a race of tall, fair-haired warriors who came with steel and fire and the seven-pointed star of the new gods painted on their chests. The wars lasted hundreds of years, but in the end, the six southern kingdoms all fell before them. Only here, where the king of the north threw back every army that tried to cross the neck, did the rule of the first men endure. The Andals burnt out the weirwood groves, hacked down the faces, slaughtered the children where they found them, and everywhere proclaimed the triumph of the seven over the old gods. So the children fled north. Summer began to howl. Maester Lewin broke off, startled. When Shaggy Dog bounded to his feet and added his voice to his brother's, dread clutched at Bran's heart.
"It's coming," he whispered, with a certainty of despair. He had known it since last night, he realized, since the crow had led him down into the crypts to say farewell. He had known it.
but he had not believed. He had wanted Maester Lewin to be right.
The crow, he thought. The three-eyed crow.
The howling stopped as suddenly as it had begun. Summer padded across the tower floor to Shaggy Dog and began to lick at a mat of bloody fur on the back of his brother's neck. From the window came a flutter of wings. A raven landed on the grey stone sill, opened its beak, and gave a harsh, raucous rattle of distress. Rickon began to cry. His arrowheads fell from his hand one by one and clattered on the floor. Bran pulled him close and hugged him. Maester Lewin stared at the black bird, as if it were a scorpion with feathers. He rose, slow as a sleepwalker, and moved to the window. When he whistled, the raven hopped onto his bandaged forearm. There was dried blood on its wings.
"A hawk," Lewin muttered. "Perhaps an owl. A poor thing. I wonder it got through."
He took the letter from its leg. Bran found himself shivering as the maester unrolled the paper. "What is it?" he said, holding his brother all the harder.
"You know what it is, boy,"
Usher said, not unkindly. She put her hand on his head. Maester Lewin looked up at them, numbly. A small, grey man, with blood on the sleeve of his grey wool robe and tears in his bright grey eyes.
"My lords," he said to the sons, in a voice gone hoarse and shrunken, We shall need to find a stone carver who knew his likeness well."
Sansa. In the tower room at the heart of Maegor's Holdfast, Sansa gave herself to the darkness. She drew the curtains around her bed, slept, woke weeping, and slept again. When she could not sleep, she lay under the blankets, shivering with grief. Servants came and went, bringing meals, but the sight of food was more than she could bear. The dishes piled up on the table beneath her window, untouched and spoiling, until the servants took them away again. Sometimes her sleep was leaden and dreamless, and she woke from it more tired than when she had closed her eyes. Yet those were the best times, for when she dreamed of father. Waking or sleeping, she saw him, saw the gold cloaks fling him down, saw Sir Ilion striding forward, unsheathing ice from the scabbard on his back, saw the moment when she had wanted to look away. She had wanted to. Her legs had gone out from under her, and she had fallen to her knees. Yet somehow she could not turn her head, and all the people were screaming and shouting, and her prince had smiled at her. He'd smiled, and she'd felt safe, but only for a heartbeat, until he said those words, and her father's legs. That was what she remembered, his legs, the way they jerked when Sir Ilion, when the sword. "Perhaps I will die too," she told herself, and the thought did not seem so terrible to her. If she flung herself from the window, she could put an end to her suffering, and in the years to come, the singers would write songs of her grief. Her body would lie on the stones below, broken and innocent, shaming all those who had betrayed her. Sansa went so far as to cross the bedchamber and throw open the shutters. But then her courage left her, and she ran back to her bed, sobbing. The serving girls tried to talk to her when they brought her meals, but she never answered them. Once Grand Maester Pycelle came, with a box of flasks and bottles, to ask if she was ill. He felt her brow, made her undress, and touched her all over while her bedmaid held her down. When he left,
He gave her a potion of honey water and herbs and told her to drink a swallow every night. She drank it all, right then, and went back to sleep. She dreamt of footsteps on the tower stair, an ominous scraping of leather on stone as a man climbed slowly toward her bedchamber, step by step. All she could do was huddle behind the door and listen, trembling as he came closer and closer. It was Sir Ilyen Payne, she knew, coming for her, with ice in his hand, coming to take her head. There was no place to run, no place to hide, no way to bar the door. Finally, the footsteps stopped, and she knew he was just outside, standing there, silent, with his dead eyes and his long, puffed face. That was when she realized she was naked. She crouched down, trying to cover herself with her hands, as the door began to swing open, creaking, the point of the great sword poking through. She woke, murmuring, "Please, please, I'll be good, I'll be good, please don't." But there was no one to hear. When they finally came for her in truth, Sansa never heard their footsteps. It was Joffrey who opened her door. Not Sir Ilyen, but the boy who had been her prince. She was in bed, curled up tight, her curtains drawn, and she could not have said if it was noon or midnight. The first thing she heard was the slam of the door. Then her bed hangings were yanked back, and she threw up a hand against the sudden light and saw them standing over her. "You will attend me in court this afternoon," Joffrey said. "See that you bathe and dress as befits my betrothed." Sandor Clegane stood at his shoulder in a plain brown doublet and green mantle, his burned face hideous in the morning light. Behind them were two knights of the King's Guard in long white satin cloaks. Sansa drew her blanket up to her chin to cover herself. "No," she whimpered. "Please, leave me be. If you won't rise and dress yourself, my hound will do it for you," Joffrey said. "I beg of you, my prince, I'm king now. Dog, get her out of bed." Sandor Clegane scooped her up around the waist and lifted her off the feather bed as she struggled feebly. Her blanket fell to the floor. Underneath, she had only a thin bedgown to cover her nakedness. "Do as you bid, child," Clegane said. "Dress." He pushed her toward her wardrobe, almost gently. Sansa backed away from them. "I did as the queen asked. I wrote the letters. I wrote what she told me. You promised you'd be merciful. Please let me go home. I won't do any treason. I'll be good, I swear it. I don't have traitor's blood. I don't. I only want to go home." Remembering her courtesies, she lowered her head. "As it please you," she finished weakly. "It does not please me," Joffrey said. "Mother says I'm still to marry you, so you'll stay here and you'll obey." "I don't want to marry you," Sansa wailed. "You chopped off my father's head. He was a traitor. I never promised to spare him, only that I'd be merciful, and I was. If he hadn't been your father, I would have had him torn or flayed. But I gave him a clean death." Sansa stared at him, seeing him for the first time. He was wearing a padded crimson doublet, patterned with lions, and a cloth of gold cape with a high collar that framed his face. She wondered how she could ever have thought him handsome. His lips were as soft and red as the worms you found after a rain, and his eyes were vain and cruel. "I hate you," she whispered. King Joffrey's face hardened. "My mother tells me that it isn't fitting that a king should strike his wife. Sir Meryn..." The knight was on her before she could think, yanking back her hand as she tried to shield her face, and backhanding her across the ear with a gloved fist. Sansa did not remember falling, yet the next she knew, she was sprawled on one knee amongst the rushes. Her head was ringing. Samerin Trant stood over her, with blood on the knuckles of his white silk glove.
"Will you obey now?"